We resume our deliberations with a discussion on insurance contracts. Andrea?
Yeah. So today we're providing you with an update on what we've been hearing in our activities to support IFRS 17 implementation. We've been engaged in these activities since the standard was issued in May 2017, and there's a summary of them in the appendix to the cover note. Today's papers cover the most recent meeting of the Transition Resource Group, which Hagit will take you to shortly, and then two papers which deal with the possibility of exploring changes to IFRS 17 in response to the concerns and implementation challenges we've heard. To be clear, at this meeting, we're not asking you to decide whether there is a need to amend IFRS 17 or to amend its effective date. What we are doing is reporting to you a summary of all the feedback we've heard and asking you to set some criteria to provide us with a framework in evaluating whether we should propose any change to IFRS 17. We'll ask in a future meeting whether any of the concerns and implementation challenges we've identified indicate a need for standard setting to amend the requirements of IFRS 17. But first, let's hear about the September TRG meeting.
Yes, thank you, Andrea. So we had our September TRG meeting. It was a two-day meeting, the third TRG meeting we held so far. You've got the summary of the meeting in appendix in Agenda Paper 2A and the submission log in Agenda Paper 2B. You can see that so far from the start we received 81 submissions that we had to deal with. 32 of them we dealt with in the last TRG meeting. Generally, very helpful discussions. We are beginning to see submissions starting to be more specific in terms of specific fact patterns that we receive. The nature is a bit different, and a very detailed discussion about mechanic aspects of the standard. So we reach a certain stage of maturity, which is, I think, very good for our TRG. What's going to happen next in terms of our TRG meetings? We have one more meeting scheduled for this year. It is scheduled for December. We will need to see, depending on the number and the nature of the submissions that we will receive for this December meeting, given it's very short time from September, whether we hold this December meeting or postpone it to the beginning of 2019. Any questions? On TRG?
That is not the case.
Okay, thank you. So let's turn now to paper 2C. And as I mentioned at the beginning, we've heard a number of concerns and implementation challenges which are summarised in paper 2D. And some have suggested that the board should consider amending the requirements of IFRS 17 to address these. And as I said today, we're not asking you whether the standard should be amended, but depending on your feedback, this meeting will bring to a future meeting a paper asking the board if any of the concerns and implementation challenges indicate that there might be a need to amend IFRS 17. In other words, to ask you which issues we should explore further. We then plan to follow up with topic-specific papers, considering whether amendments in each area are justified. So at this meeting, we're asking you to set some criteria, which will provide us with a framework for assessing whether there's a need to propose changes to IFRS 17. And the criteria we've recommended focus on two aspects. One is avoiding the loss of useful information compared to the information that would be available if IFRS 17 were applied. And the second is avoiding disruption for those entities that are further advanced in their implementation processes or risking undue delays in the effective date of a standard that is much needed to address the existing situation with the wide range of insurance accounting practices under IFRS 4. So the staff recommendations are summarised in paragraphs 5 and 6 of the paper 2C. And I think it's worth noting at this point that we're thinking of these criteria as a way of limiting the extent of changes to IFRS 17. And it's not the case that we think that every proposed change that meets these criteria should be made. So in other words, we're seeing these criteria as a necessary condition for change, but not a sufficient criteria for change. I'd also like to note that there's been some discussion of the effective date of IFRS 17, and Agenda Paper 2D describes some concerns of the effective date as it stands now. Obviously, any amendments that we might make has implications not just for disrupting implementation, but also for the effective date. which we would need to consider when we're assessing possible changes as well. So with those warnings in place, I'll hand over the discussion of the criteria for assessing possible amendments to you.
There have not been any suggestions that would lead to an increase in significant, in useful information.
Well, there have been some suggestions, but whether those might disrupt implementation is a different question. Eliminate options.
Amaru.
Thanks, Hans. A few comments on the set of papers first. I really like the way you provide this whole set of information. I think it's very useful, and it's very positive for us to have detailed information what's going on in such a complex standard. I really would like to praise the work that's been done by the TRG. The fact that we use specialists that are truly involved with the process of implementing the standard and helping us understand the challenge that they do have in terms of implementation is also very helpful. So, and I personally take it, and I believe the foundation, the ISB as a whole, take it very, very carefully, everything that is discussed and the points that are made. So the whole set, I think it's very sensible for the staff to provide or to try to set criteria for a potential amendments to IFRS 17 if the amendments are deemed to be necessary. In my view, they are in the right direction, as we used to say. I just felt that the two criteria set, or among the criteria set, and you are suggesting two, I felt that one was missing, at least in my reading. And to me, the key criteria is to keep the principles that we set in IFRS 17. So here, the criteria are associated with information that is useful and implementation efforts. I don't know if behind the thinking of the information that is useful, you are encompassing everything that is associated with IFRS 17. I can read that way, but I didn't. So if it's that way, please clarify, because I can, one can view this very holistically and then understand, oh, when they are talking about keep no loss of useful information, they are already saying, well, we'll keep an eye to the principles that are the basis for IFRS 17. Another thing that I think is somewhere here, maybe around the wording, is probably associated with delays of disrupt implementation process, might be costs and benefits associated. But again, because the words are not here, I'm not sure you have this in mind when you drafted this proposed criteria. And two others that came to my mind when reading these, since we are talking about amendments, I would expect to see in written, and I did again, I didn't. One is if those amendments are meant to be responsive to what we have been hearing and to be helpful for the implementation of IFRS 17, and we are not discussing yet the effective date, we are talking about amendments, so I guess the amendments are meant to be helpful in implementing. I would expect them to be narrow in scope. And in this sense, ideally, issues that could be efficiently resolved by the board. Or in other words, we are not expect to take months deliberating about one amendment. So I guess those are questions, comments, much more than specifics into the what is written.
Tak,
thank you. First of all, I really appreciate the work has been done by the staff members. And also, I would like to respect the discussion which was made in the TLG meeting, and it is a huge contribution. Now we can identify that some problem, implementation problem, and that those are the issues which we can use for the improvement of IFRS 17. Having said that, reopening IFRS 17 is completely different things, other things. Actually, reopening the final standard is something quite challenging things because IFRS 17 is a final standard. It's not the exposure draft. So we published it to be implemented as it is written. So therefore, people are preparing based on the our final standard. So therefore, if we try to change the some of the final standard, that would cause a significant impact for those who have already started preparation. So we understand there is some issues to be improved, but once we make a change, then that would may cause us a significant impact. And then those who have been prepared wouldn't be happy. Then even if we made an improvement, there is no guarantee that our improvement would be embraced by the constituents. So the impact could be significant once we made an improvement and make an exposure draft, and there might be a strong pushback. We will be very much in a troubled situation. So situation wouldn't be changed even if we made an improvement. So that is my big concern. And it is really challenging. And also, 25 issues are quite significant issues. And some of the issues are quite difficult to deal with. I don't think we cannot, I don't think we can reach, you know, easy solution. So like Amaro pointed out, I think as a criteria, we need some criteria which we can sort out efficiently, like we have in due process for implementation IFRIC meeting. So that's very important. Having said that, still it causes a lots of unfair treatment because we have 25 issues. Maybe we cannot pick up 25. So if we pick up some, then those who have been picked up would be happier, but those who failed to be picked up would be very upset. So the whole process is really challenging. And also thinking about timeline, because it's a final standard, if we reopen it, we have to publish an exposure draft. We have to go through the old due process, balloting and everything, and get the feedback and the re-deliberation. So it's really challenging. So once we assess all these issues, then we have to sit back and think again whether or not it is strategically right for us to reopen it. So that's what we need to think about in the last stage.
Martin.
Yeah, I agree with the criteria which the staff has in this paper, because I think on the one hand side, clearly, I have always said also at TRG meetings that, okay, clearly we are open to listen and to respond if we getting kind of new information, but this new information and then based on if we do any change should not against the core principles of the standard, which Amaro said, or I think the core themes, and I think that is more or less said in this first principle or the first criteria which we have. And the secondly, which is also important, is timing, because we have also some people saying, okay, we need more time to implement the standard. Some say 1 year, months, and 2 years. And I think that is the second criteria. But also, I think that is not only implementation, that is also, I think, we getting voices, people saying we need now this information based on this standard, and we should not forget that it's linked for some of the insurance companies with also implementation and effective date of IFRS 9. So I think that is, although the market is looking for this kind of more comparable, more information, and that is one of our, I think, key objectives which we want to fulfill with this standard. So I think it is an, if we would open the standard and do some amendments, it is a kind of balancing act, and we have to consider these both elements. And I think for that reason, I think that is the right criteria, because man, clearly if we have some new information, it is an easy fix, easy change without doing anything against the benefits. If we have time to do that in a time frame, clearly why should we not do that? But then we have to go through issue by issue and say, okay, what is then, can we do it in the respective time, which we think is what we can do, maybe 1 or 2 years, and does it not against our principles which we have in the standards? Therefore, I think it is the right criterion if we then in a later meeting go through the different issues and decide, okay, what we can do, what we can't do. And it is not to make some people happy, others not happy. It is okay if we think there is an issue which can be dealt with, can be fixed, and can be improved in the certain time frame, I would say, why not doing it? But then we have to assess, I think, item by item, if we can achieve that based on this criteria. Therefore, I think it is the right criteria, because we have to look what the market is looking for information with IFRS 17, but also with 9 for some entities, but not okay that the benefits of this standard would be what our objectives was when we have finalized the standards.
Mary.
Couple of things about the criteria. One, I think they're the right questions that we should be asking, so I support the two that you have here. There's another factor, maybe it's a criterion, maybe it's something else that I'd just like you to incorporate, not a criticism for not having done it, just thinking ahead, is understanding whether something is on the list because we have substantial new information about it. If it's something that we considered in deliberating, you know, the final standard, is it something about which we have substantially new information, maybe unexpected costs or some other feature that is new versus something that we were aware of and considered, but people want to make sure that you have raised to us for completeness ongoing concerns with the original decision. Yeah, those are two different things. So I think it kind of falls into cost benefit, but I think I'd like that information about each of the issues. And then secondly, with respect to the first criterion of would not result in significant loss of useful information, I think this is absolutely the right framework in which we should be looking at, you know, doing the analysis of each of the issues. I think it would be helpful when you're applying that criterion to each of the individual issues that are in paper D, to get from a general level of, you know, loss of useful information to, for example, what pieces of information would be lost and how did we expect those to be used. I think just making it specific again, I think you guys have done an amazing job in terms of what you pulled together in paper D. So, but that was just meant to give us a flavor. And so this is how I think I'd like to see these criterion operationalized against the individual issues. So I think it's the right ones, but I think it has to drill down a bit more.
Nick?
Thank you. So really to offer some investor perspective here. Probably the most significant change in financial reporting I saw during my 3 decades as an investor was the adoption of international accounting standards. And it brought significant benefits to investors, to savers, to companies, and probably to economies. And those benefits were available virtually for everyone, with the exception of the insurance industry because of IFRS 4. And that's not through want of trying on our part, I'd say. Mm-hmm. And so we went out in May 2017, May last year, with IFRS 17. And since then, we met with, I think, over 500 analysts and investors. And 3 consistent messages came back. The new standard would offer more consistency, greater comparability, and more transparency. And there was a real prospect of the generalist investor returning to the sector. Many generalist investors have given up on the sector altogether. And I think the prospect of further changes and delay will just only be met by, with dismay by investors. Mm. They have waited long enough. So I feel even reluctant to consider the criteria. If I must, I feel that probably these are the right criteria that we have. I think it's very right that we have a high hurdle here for change. And as others said, we must have, any amendments must be narrow in scope and deliverable in a timely fashion.
Chen Chow.
Thank you. Just to follow up Nick's point, actually, during past months, I also reached out to engage some stakeholders and the users. The feedback I got from users, exactly the same as Nick, they are quite positive with our standard, especially with regard to basic principle of IFRS 17. They believe that this standard can provide useful information and transparent, improve transparency and comparability of insurance companies. And I, with regard to papers, I supported the staff's approach because staff work very hard. They collect almost all the feedback, summarize all those issues within the paper, and show that if we are going to make any amendment, the hurdle will be very high. So I agree the approach first, establish the criteria first, and then use those criteria to assess those issues, whether those issues meet, if there are potential to amendment, to do some amendment, whether they meet the criteria. And also I like the paper addressed that even board will decide to do something to make any amendment, it should be subjected to the due process. So with regard to the criteria, I fully agree with two criteria. But in the meantime, I think I agree with Amaro and Tak's point that when even some issue meets the criteria and we decide to do some amendment, I think it should be, those issues could be fixed very quickly and efficiently. Otherwise, it will not be meet the second criteria. It will result and duly disrupt those companies already implement IFRS 17. So I think we should focus those issues. We can quick fix, quick win, and quick benefits of those stakeholders.
Gary.
Thank you. And, like others, I'm very complimentary of the staff work product here. Especially considering the subject nature, it's actually very readable for a very difficult subject. But a few thoughts. I'm actually not surprised we are where we are. I mean, this is, when you get a standard that's this complex and this pervasive, I'm not surprised some things need to be addressed. I mean, we had similar issues in IFRS 15. It came to the TRG for the most part. But essentially, the standard didn't work in some limited or narrow things that needed attention. And that's how I sort of see this one. So I think I'm looking at things. I think the criteria, I think, are the right criteria. The first thing about significant loss of useful information, I think, that fits the conceptual framework for faith representation and for relevance. I think the other one about not unduly disruptive fits the third criteria for standard change, which is the benefits exceed the costs. Somebody had said it earlier, but I think it's worth reinforcing. The fact to get through these two filters, it still may fail. Either the costs don't justify the benefits, or it's a very narrow issue that's, or it's not pervasive. It's in one country, or it's in one contract type or something. So there's a lot of reasons why it still might not go forward, but let's assume we get past that. We got to consider what changes, if anything, we might make. To me, I know we have a nice list of 25 or so items, maybe a few get added to it or something, or maybe more research if you drop. But first thing I would like to know, which of those we just underestimated the level of work. The standard isn't the problem, it's just the timeline. You know, we need, it's more work than us or the outreach told us to be. And if you add a year or 2 years, whatever it is, we'll just solve itself just by making more time available. I think that's the first filter. We should, that holds the standard as written. The effective date is an easy enough thing to change without worrying about other consequential problems a change, you know, of debits and credits might cause. Then, assuming something is still standing that needs attention, I would then look to, are there practical expedients that we could put in as opposed to, you know, that get to the same end point, but perhaps a little bit less torturous or workload path. And we certainly did plenty of those in 15 and later in IFRS 16 as well, but it doesn't change the desired end point. It changes just some of the procedures needed to get there. So I think we should think about that. And then, you know, I don't know what sort of outside of the box thinking, you know, might come about. One item that came to me is to the extent that this is primarily a matter of time at issue as opposed to we just disagree or the standard doesn't work or whatever, is you could, if we delayed, if we didn't change the effective date, but you didn't require 2020 to be comparable, would it be so ridiculous to think in the reporting entity's primary statements, 2020 on the old basis, you almost got like a memo to new basis 2021, and that becomes the earliest comparable year the next year. That buys a whole year or more into the process. I'm thinking, where can you think outside the box without going inside the standard itself? And then I think if we delay it more, if we get to that point where we delay the effective date more than a year or two, I think we got to take a look at decoupling the IFRS 9 effective date again. So by then, it'll been out there 7 or 8 years in the single biggest sets of portfolios out there that applies to. Again, I'm not suggesting what the answer should be. I just think it needs to be processed. Thank you.
Darren?
So a couple of things. I guess the starting point, I agree with Tuck in saying that we really need to have a high hurdle for change in thinking about what, if anything, we decide to change down the process. And I think we need to be careful of allowing ourselves to be pulled into something that starts to feel like it's inevitable. I really think there should be a high hurdle any time we think about changing an existing standard, and any time we think about changing an existing standard at this stage of an implementation process. So I think that for me is critical. I also like the idea, Tuck, and I think it was you that suggested it, is that even if we go ahead with this criteria, at some point we need to take a step back and look at the package and say, is this really worth the cost and effort of going through it? And I think, Andrea, to an extent, that was your, I think, necessary but not sufficient comment, which I thought is a very nice way of thinking about it. These are the criteria that get us to a point, but I don't think that the simple meeting of these criteria suggests that the overall cost benefit is met. Picked up a little bit on what others have said about principles and things like that, and I think there's quite a lot of detail and perhaps some important messaging in this first set of criteria, the criteria A. I look at something like internal inconsistencies. Internal inconsistencies in some ways for me is code for exceptions. It's taking a principle, as Amara said, and then adding an exception to it. And I think a lot of what people seem to be suggesting through the process is they would like an exception to it. And every time we do that, somewhere in the document we talk about complexity, and I think we risk increasing complexity. And I think that's a significant thing that we need to be aware of as we go through the process. So I'm certainly reading A2 as talking about, at least in part, the effect of exceptions coming in. And then we talk about the increased complexity for users. And I think the point that Nick made is one that I've heard quite a lot. There's an element of people saying they just want to get the standard out there. They want to get working with it. They want to see the numbers and start getting better insight into what's happening within the industry. And there's almost a little bit of dismay that we're even having this meeting among some of the users I've been speaking to, because it feels a little bit like a repeat of what has happened in other places. So I think it's important that we bear in mind a balanced view of what user requirements are, of what users would like from the standard.
And increased complexity for users very often comes with optionality. And so I think that's another really important consideration as we go through the process. So generally speaking, then, taking into account those comments, I'm very supportive of the criteria that you've got here. I think there's one other thing I'd like to commend staff on. I think it is good, as much as it might have been a little bit painful, I think it's good that we've waited this long to bring these issues, because I think that has given the opportunity for people going through the implementation process to have worked through all of the issues. And I think that gives us a fair amount of comfort that we are seeing the issues that have come out during that process. And I think that's helpful for us as we sort of take the process forward.
Councilor Ivan.
Well, like others have already said, I think the set of papers really reflect very positively on all the efforts that have been made in support to the implementation of IFRS 17. And I think the place we are today is just the place where we should be. That is, in fact, considering the list of issues without any preconceived assessment as to what comes next, and having in mind that I think the criteria that are proposed, I think are good criteria, because I regard them as setting high hurdles for change. I read them as encompassing the element that Amaro has indicated, instead, you know, the consistency goes with not being contradictory to the core principles. So I think that's there. And also, when we have in B, not risk undue delays with the effective date, by definition, it means that we are not going to embark in anything that we would not be able to tackle in a timely fashion. And I also agree that it's not one by one, but it's also, I mean, one by one is the first step, but I also agree that we need to have an overall assessment after a detailed analysis before embarking in anything. So I think you have prepared our job very well so that we can proceed in an orderly fashion.
Sure.
Thanks. I want to start first also by thanking the staff, not least because they came straight off a TRG meeting and to preparing these papers above and beyond. But I agree with the criteria that are proposed here, and certainly I would agree with the comments Amaro made, but for me they were implicit in these criteria when I think about them. And I think it is very important, the point that Andrea made about these are necessary but not sufficient criteria for me. One thing I think I'm going to be thinking very hard about when we ultimately are asked to make decisions about what, if any, of the 25 issues we want to address is this effect on implementation processes and the potential effective date of the standard. Because I think it's really important that that by even having this conversation, we don't create a feeling in the market that there's a need to down tools because you might be wasting time putting in place the processes that you're working on now. I think anything we do, we need to be incredibly disciplined as a board, both to make sure that we're not preventing people continuing in good faith implementing the standard as it's written today, and also that we don't get into a situation where we get bogged down in debate on, you know, fine technical issues that go on for months and months and months looking for the perfect solution, because I think we need to be really disciplined to not disrupt implementation, but not also to get into a deliberation process that's so lengthy in itself that it's causing this disruption that we're trying to avoid. And I think the staff will need to keep reminding us of being disciplined in the way that we look at issues. I think we need to be looking at things, if we're going to address stuff, that are what we call in the interpretation committee land surgical strikes, things that can be quite discreetly dealt with, and that for me is the only sort of thing I'd be countenancing.
Tom?
First of all, I really strongly support approaching this with some criteria. I think that was excellent because it's going to corral what we do. And it's also going to set expectations for people because they know what the ground rules are. With that regard, then it becomes very important that the ground rules we set are good ones. And I agree with the staff. I'm going to possibly just check on a couple of potential additions. First, a quick question, though. In A, the word significant appears in the first line, and it's appropriate for me to carry that significant to points 1, 2, and 3, right? Yes? Yeah. Okay. Yes. So just because I just wanted to make sure that it wasn't kind of narrowly. And the second one, it's sort of, I think if I got what Amaro said, I think that if there are some fundamental principles in the standard, they don't get violated is a great one. And then the other one, though, that I'm not sure about, and I just want to ask about is, in paper 2C, it talks about costs and benefits in several, or refers to costs and benefits in several places. And Mary brought up a kind of a neat idea is how does an item get on the list? And one of the examples she gave is there are unexpected costs. And so my question is, in the criteria, if we find that doing something a certain way has a large magnitude unexpected costs, that doesn't seem to be covered in the criteria. So because at that point you would be trading off A potentially against this unexpected high cost, and that's not the way we've set the criteria, that's not on the table.
No, so I think we were thinking that there would be an assessment of whether there is a need for change, yeah, and then any proposed solutions would need to meet the criteria. So the bit you're talking about, the unexpectedly high cost, for example, might indicate there's a need to change, but that would be the subject of a topic-specific paper which we come to at a later date. What we're trying to get at the moment is there will be some things that there's no way of addressing it without disrupting implementation, for example, and those would be something that we suggest we don't explore further.
Yeah, so
we need to make the, even if things meet the criteria, we also need to justify to you why you should make a change, yeah, at
and,
all.
And that's my question, is if we get to one of those and the change is somewhat significant, I'll skip the undo for now, but it's really high cost, much higher cost than we expected. That's not on the table. We can't have that discussion. Because our criteria have excluded the last one.
First thing you'll be asked is there a need to amend?
Yeah.
And you'll have to decide that. And if we think there's a need to amend, then we need to check whether we meet the criteria.
That's, yeah, because how you can amend something can be done in a number of different ways.
So if we see high costs, we amend if we can do it without undue loss of information.
You're convinced by the
But argument. If we can't do that, we live with the costs. That's the way I read the criteria now.
I think
I'm willing to enforce these. I just want to know what I'm enforcing.
Sure. I think you need to be careful. I'm assuming that using high cost is shorthand, because I think there's no doubt that we knew that IFRS 17 would be costly to implement. So high cost in and of itself is not.
No, that's why I cited Mary. I think Mary made an excellent distinction.
Is what new high cost, yeah, or unexpectedly high cost. And even so, we'd need to balance that up against what we thought of, yeah, the usefulness of the information, yeah, and whether the benefit of the useful information.
But that's what I'm asking, is can you do the balance? As written, there's no question of balancing.
It's in the assessment of whether there's a need to amend, is,
yes,
the intention,
yeah,
of how,
yes,
you think it's going to work.
Absolutely.
Which is Tom's question. How's the staff think it would be built in? It would be built into the initial assessment of, is there a need to amend?
Yeah.
Make a, just think about unexpected costs or whatever the example is we're using. And then having been through that, we think about whether we meet the criteria. So it's a sort of two-step process.
And then once we meet... Okay, well, I'll leave it. I'm going to just kind of come back to the idea that there is going to be some sense of balance, yep, where there really are very high new costs.
That would come under the assessment about whether there is a need to amend.
Right.
But we've indicated in paper 2D already the sorts of things that we've heard. So you can see already where we've heard feedback that they are higher than anticipated implementation costs in the DSM.
Jung
Woo. Thank you. I agree with these two criteria, but I would like to emphasize the Mary Sue's suggestion. We need a kind of additional guidance to think about each topic later. Now, we shouldn't repeat the discussions in the past we had very long time. So our requirement now is a kind of a best optimal, you know, solution consensus among board members a long time ago. So we shouldn't repeat that again here. If we, you know, as you said, Sue said, if we just start, you know, this on some topics at a fresh mind, it'll take time and time. Also, most of them are repeating, being repeated in board members. So we need to be very careful not to repeat the discussions in the past. So that's a kind of a very special guidance we should keep in mind and think about.
We'll try to indicate to the extent we've discussed things before.
Anne?
I agree with the criteria that the staff have brought to us. I would be a person very reluctant to open the standard because of the issues that are being put on the table. A lot of work went into the standard, a lot of feedback gathered. There were compromises in there. And there are people waiting for this standard, and we do believe there are enormous benefits to come from the standard. And some of our feedback has indicated to us that there is a process we use through the TRG and through the post-implementation reviews for improving standards. So should we decide to open, I'll be a reluctant person.
Well, I agree with all those who praised the staff for doing an excellent job in preparing these papers. But I also, like many of you, I have read these papers with a very heavy heart. And I would really hope that we could get this standard in function before the next financial crisis. Mm. And I really don't mean that flippantly, because I first of all, even if we were not to delay by one day, it's the question whether that will happen. And if there is going to be a delay, the risk of that happening will increase. And if you just, you can see at the markets to these days that the markets are incredibly nervous, and they have a lot to be nervous about. Especially there is a lot of nervousness about the quality of the debt markets in which insurance companies are extremely active. There is simply way too much debt in the economy, more than 300% of global GDP. There has been an explosion of corporate debt, and there has been an explosion of low-quality, still investment-grade, triple B debt. And there is a lot in the search for yield. There is a lot of debt being sold of non-investment-grade. And a year ago, the IMF warned that even in insurance companies, in their search for yield, were more and more investing in non-investment grade debt. And then to think that they will not even be applying IFRS 9 is just intolerable. So any risk of disrupting implementation, risking delay of the standard, it's very hard to accept. So we need very high hurdles, and anything that we can do must be long. And this is what I said in the Financial Stability Board meeting earlier this week. It has to be fine-tuning, and it has to be the main legitimation must be to decrease cost for implementation. And I also think you cannot just look at all the issues by themselves, because it could also be that we more than one or two issues pass these tests, but then the total number of issues becomes so big that it will still disrupt implementation. So that's also something that we should look at. And, you know, peeking ahead at the next paper, I wonder if there are already not too many issues being identified that could pass one of these tests. So it is with great chagrin that I'm discussing these papers. And there's also, frustration, because I know that if everybody was just equally convinced of the urgency of this standard, we wouldn't be sitting here discussing these issues. Okay. Who supports the staff's recommendation?
Paper that is agenda paper 2D. This paper provided an overview of the concern and implementation challenges that have been raised by stakeholders since the issuance of the standard. This paper has been prepared using the information that we gathered during our activities to support the implementation of IFRS 17, including more than 300 meetings with stakeholders and also considering the TRG discussion. The paper lists 25 topics, and for each topic, the paper includes four sections. So an overview of the requirements of IFRS 17 for that specific topic, the board's rationale for setting those requirements, the concern and implementation challenges expressed, and some preliminary staff thoughts against the criteria for evaluating possible changes that we have just discussed. As mentioned by Andrea, at this meeting, we are not asking you to make any decision. At a future meeting, we plan to ask you if you want us to explore possible changes for the topics discussed in the paper that meet the criteria that we have just discussed. A preliminary staff assessment against those criteria is included in the paper under the section Staff Preliminary Thoughts. So today, we would welcome your comments, questions, and preliminary views on the analysis in the paper. And in particular, we would appreciate any comments on the staff preliminary thought for each topic. So looking to the paper and on pages 3 and 4, there is a table that lists all the different topics, following the order of the requirements in the standard, given that different stakeholders have expressed different concerns and implementation challenges with different level of importance. So we are not able to list the topics by priority. And it's important to remember that insurers are moving to IFRS 17 starting from very different starting point, given the wide range of accounting practices permitted by IFRS 4. So I think that it's quite understandable that different preparers are expressing different concerns and are facing different implementation challenges. For the discussion, I would propose just to follow the order of the topics in the paper and maybe to group together topics that are somehow linked, for example, reinsurance, the effective date, and transition. So I would start from topic one, which actually is not directly related with topic two. So topic one is about the population of contracts that are in the scope of IFRS 17. And I would ask board members if you have any comment, particularly on the staff preliminary thoughts for this topic one.
Okay.
I've already noted the overall comment from Mary that we need to further expand the section talking about what useful information means in the specific context. So this comment I did apply to all the topics in the list.
The good news is I'm not going to say it 25.
Okay. Good. The second topic is about the level of aggregation. Do you have any comment or observation on this?
Only that the concrete suggestion I have picked up from the market to change this is too cute by half.
Yeah, I have a comment on this one.
Okay, thank you.
So I hope my comment fits into what you expect from us. I tend to agree with the staff preliminary thoughts on this. However, I regard this issue as having been identified, if I'm not mistaken, as having been identified as a source of...
We cannot hear you, Françoise.
Okay, I restart. I started by saying that I shared the preliminary thoughts of staff on this issue. But if I'm not mistaken, this issue has been identified as bringing a significant costs in implementation, and is disputed on this account. I think it is also partly discussed on the basis of relevance for, in particular, the contracts which are accounted for following the variable fee approach. Mm-hmm. So even if on the basis of your preliminary thoughts, I think, and I know we have already had a number of documents and communication explaining why this grouping were necessary. But given the sensitivity, the way I perceive it, I think having a full analysis of how IFRS 17 really takes, why these annual quotes are necessary, and how the IFRS 17 takes into account the interdependency between generations of policyholders for those contracts with discretionary participation features. I think having the full analysis eventually again, but even more deeply, would be necessary to really convey the soundness of our decision.
By the way, I don't dispute what François said, that this is going to involve significant costs for the industry. But would it be fair to say that if we would impose this requirement on the rest of the world, so non-insurance companies, that it would be experienced as a significant cost relief? Yes, even the fact that all other companies have to account for contracts individually. Right?
Yes.
It's not just a rhetorical question. Mary?
Well, I understand, I think, why Françoise is making the points that she made about this has been an almost immediate and ongoing source of expressions of concern about cost of implementation. When I read through the concerns and implementation challenges listed in paragraphs 35, 36, they are all familiar to me from the discussions that we had in the finalization of the standard. And this is maybe where I come to saying it would be helpful for me to understand in assessing issues whether there's new information or not. And then the information that's new may be around costs, or it may be around something else. But if it, I agree absolutely that if we have heard this frequently in the outreach, especially from preparers, that it should be included in the list of issues that was brought to the board's attention. But I think we should be disciplined, thinking about all the things we said in relation to the last paper, to not reopen and redeliberate exactly the same decisions with no new information that we deliberated previously. And so I think maybe having a reminder on what we considered before, you know, in reaching these conclusions might be useful and might satisfy some of what Françoise said. But I think I would be loath to say, just because a lot of people are pushing back on a decision we reached in the final standard, that we should reconsider it absent new information, because that seems to be contrary to the things that, you know, Amaro and Tak cited, for example, about issues that we can resolve rapidly, you know, if we were to consider standard setting.
Okay, Martin?
Yeah, on this issue, man, based on this criteria which you discussed earlier, man, I clearly think, okay, if we would say, okay, that some are not happy with the annual cohorts and get rid of the annual cohorts, for me, clearly would against the first criteria, because then we have a big mishmash of averaging of everything, which I think would, destroy our, one of the core principles is to make the profitability of insurance contracts and companies more transparent. And if we have a big mishmash averaging of everything, I think that is a core principle which we should violate. But what does it mean? Okay, man, if we now, people think, okay, new information is in this regard, because people think, okay, this is higher cost than expected to have this average, this annual cohorts. But do we think, okay, discussing if we opening the standard alternative solutions for that? But then I think the second criteria comes into play, because I think to discuss now maybe alternative solutions, I have not seen any so far, but maybe people come up with that. But if that would take us in discussion of another 1 or 2 years, I think that would against the second criteria. And therefore, I think that is a way I understand the staff preliminary conclusion works. But is that right, or do we then now open it for people coming with maybe good solutions or that? Because man, that is the first criteria is always a is difficult, because man, maybe there are alternatives to achieve that, but then the second criteria comes into play. Is that the way how the staff thinks the criteria works into play?
Well, I think the way we think the criteria works is if we think that what we're trying to achieve is something which results in the loss of useful information, for example, getting rid of the annual cohorts, then we don't even need to go as far as considering alternative ways to do it, because the outcome of the standard is the outcome of the standard, and that's what we want to achieve. So we wouldn't go as far as exploring different ways to achieve the same objective, because we think that would the intent is to counteract the objective.
Okay.
Daryl. A couple of points. I think this is actually quite a useful one for thinking about the criteria, because it brings a lot of the discussion in the previous session to the fore, I think. So I agree with Francois. This is certainly the issue that we've heard perhaps the most discussion about, and certainly people have identified this as one of the sources of high cost in the process of implementing 17. But then I think to Mary's point, I think we knew that going in. We knew, and certainly the industry was not quiet when we were talking about this at the in the earlier processes. And I think what we've heard equally is support from the user community about the idea that this will provide useful information about the evolution of profitability over time. So it seems to, a little bit to Tom's point, yes, there is costs involved here, but yes, there are benefits that equate to those costs. So I think that's an important one. And I think, back to Mary's point, I think we really need to be careful that we don't end up relitigating issues, rediscussing the same issues that we've discussed previously. There's one other point I think we need to be quite careful of in the process over the next couple of months, is that we don't end up being tempted to interpret what things might be or what the outcomes might be. I think to all the others who said, let's keep it simple, I think that's really important that we do try and keep the process as simple as possible. I did have one other point. I do think that it may be that when you bring this paper back to us, when you come back at the later session, that we might want to expand a little bit on some of the reasoning as has come out and around the table, because I think that's important to get that out there.
All right.
Okay, so let's move to topic number 3, about acquisition cost, acquisition cash flows for the renewal outside the contract country. No comments on this one. We can move to topic 4, which is about the use of the lock-in discount rate to adjust the contractual service margin. Then topic number 5 is about the subjectivity in determining the discount rate and the risk adjustment.
Nick?
Just to reflect, this is clearly a concern that we've heard from investors as we've done outreach, but I think it's important that we stick to the principle and the standard. So there's disclosure there, very adequate disclosure to reflect any differences. So I think here the principle is the right thing to stick with.
Mary?
A couple of things in terms of the analysis of this issue that I think would be helpful for the next time we look at it. One is, it feels a bit abstract to me, and you know, in terms of basic objectives that we have for our standards, and I think it would be helpful to maybe amplify how some of the thoughts about avoiding using rules-based approach being more specific about what the consequences would be. It's not that I have a sudden fondness for rules or, you know, reluctance to embrace principles, but I think I want in each case to understand the implications, maybe slightly more detail, not pages, paragraphs, not pages, in terms of that. And the second is I didn't spot an analysis of the second criterion about whether or not it would be disrupt, you know, the impact from a disruption perspective. And I don't know if that's because you thought that there was such a high likelihood of loss of information that you wouldn't go on to the second criterion, but it may be worth, I think it's, there, we may end up assessing these more as kind of gradations of the criterion rather than on-off switches, like maybe more high impact in terms of loss of useful information, you know, low impact rather than yes, no. And in that case, it might be helpful to have the other aspect as well in terms of impact on disruption. So I think I'd like to see both things. So I could maybe think of it as each as more on a spectrum.
Yeah, we can consider to provide the comment for each criterion and not just for the first one in case it is not met.
Okay, move on.
One question, man. Is the next step that we have on each of these issues and a detailed paper where you go against this criteria, or do we?
Not an individual. It will be an expansion of the analysis paragraphs, not pages, on the issue
of this.
Okay.
That's why I said paragraphs, not pages.
Okay. Roberta?
Okay, so the next topic is number 6. It's about risk adjustment in a group of entities. This is an issue that was discussed by the TLG. Do you have any comments?
I think this is actually another example of something that is a useful test of thinking about the criteria. Because it's very tempting to think that we can just make this change, and it's probably a relatively easy change from a standard setting perspective to make. But I think what we heard at the TRG is that there are different ways that people are looking at it, and they've gone ahead and started looking at actually implementing based on those ways. So I think it's useful here that the second criteria comes into play, and I think this is, for me anyway, a good use of that second criteria.
Well, I mean, on this one, and in fact, it raises the question whenever this criteria of disruption in implementation will kick in with forcefully. I think, you know, I don't know what you intend to bring back to us, but right now what we have is a statement. And I see that Daryl refers to the elements of discussion at the TRG that I'm not knowledgeable of. But I think it would be important to us to understand what is the critical aspect in implementation in relation to the issue, not only a statement. Otherwise, we have no assessment of ours.
Tom?
Quick question. So, just so I'm clear, in some of the 25, the staff are more sympathetic than others in the summaries, my view. You don't have to answer. Are all 25 coming back, or is it going to be a subset of the ones that sort of pass the criteria?
We will be analyzing the 25 against the criteria and asking you to decide which ones you want us to explore, which will be in detailed papers.
So all 25 are still going to be on the table?
Next month or the month after.
Okay, I just wanted to check that. So I won't quibble over any wording or anything in here because this is just a quick look.
Well, to the extent that you think we need to provide you with information to help you make that decision, I think it's useful for you to give us that indication so that we can make sure we cover off what you're looking for.
I'll raise on this one.
But the decision that Andrea refers to is the assessment versus the criteria, not whether or not we should.
Yeah, so I just, in paragraph 78, 78. This is, we're on number 6, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Is it 78? And I just want to make sure that, so is staff think, and again, I'm looking down the road a little bit, provides that it might unduly disrupt implementation processes. So it's going to fail. And just like, how solid is our ground on, like, I don't want to have a whole pile of people saying, wouldn't disrupt ours sort of thing.
I think it's the same comment that was raised by Francoise to explain better why we think that this will disrupt implementation.
And Tom, I think you might have actually hit something on the head a little bit there, is that I suspect, and this goes right back to something we were talking about, that Roberto was talking about at the beginning, to my mind, is that people are starting in different places. So this enjoyed quite an energetic debate at the TRG, and it was essentially two camps coming from different places in the way they looked at it. And I think that to me is what made me think when I looked at this one that it's likely to have a bit of a effect on implementation, with sort of half the people saying, oh, we love that idea, that's great, and the other half saying, oh, you can't do this to us. And I think that is the problem, is almost certainly if the disruption to implementation is likely to affect people unevenly.
Yeah.
Well, to be blunter than you, I think that there were different readings of the words, and so people were happy with the camps they got themselves into.
Yes.
Okay.
Next one, number 7. So is the contractor service margin and the allocation of the contractor service margin for contract in the general model. So this is the topic that the board discussed last June. If you have any comment.
Mary? Yeah.
I hate to disappoint you, Roberta, by confessing that I can't off the top of my head do all the basis for conclusion and other commentary in the standard about the reasons we selected the criteria we did for the for what qualifies for the variable fee approach. And I'm not so much worried about what the criteria are, but what were the characteristics that we considered important to modify the general model for, you know, that they warranted getting different accounting, and why we place so much emphasis on them. So in terms of analyzing this issue, I think it would be helpful in terms of understanding what the features were to just be reminded of what we had. And then that's one point. And the second is with respect to paragraph 84. Again, it says whether the coverage duration includes periods, and you're focusing on periods here. And I think there may be two, my understanding of this issue, which I haven't set in on all the TRG discussions about this, so I may not have the full picture, but it's both a question of how many periods, but also what proportion you give to investment. And I think it would be helpful to separate the analysis of the two aspects, because the variable fee does, it modifies the accounting for the investment return. It's not just an attribution change.
Yeah. Yes.
And I think understanding whether people are talking about solely about attribution, and if so, if they're talking about period, you know, how many periods, or whether they're talking about some kind of further distinction, would be useful to better understand what the issue is that's being raised.
Thank you. I think this is one of the most difficult issues to address. Actually, we decided to propose some annual improvement, but this annual improvement has a serious byproduct, which made it clear that for general model, you cannot allocate over the coverage period. However, it was not very clear before we made a proposal. So actually, it could disrupt the preparation. And so therefore, actually, the annual improvement itself is somehow disrupting some preparation. So if we finalize annual improvement, we definitely need to address for general model as well. But think it the other way around. If we didn't have annual improvement, there is a possibility that practice can swallow
the you know issues, because our literature was not good enough. So in some sense, it was not very clear. So, and the principle of CSM, in a sense, is very clear. It's to provide it provides information about service allocation. And the service allocation includes not only just insurance coverage, but also benefit which the insurer is providing to the policyholder. So therefore, if you look at the purpose of the CSM, then an entity can make a high-level judgment if there is a significant service which is quite longer than the coverage period. They can make a judgment. So considering the reluctance of reopening the IFRS 17, we can avoid this issue by pulling out our annual improvement. That is my suggestion.
We are not in the business of promoting creative accounting to solve these kind of issues.
Yeah. However, high-level judgment should be allowed.
I think this is a discussion we've already had.
Yeah, I understand.
There is a disagreement,
John Wu.
Thank you. I have the same idea with the talks. So this was already discussed in February. That's satisfied with that annual improvement. So if you see that paragraph 88, there's no assessment on these two criteria, whether this subject topic satisfying or not. But you just said the step are exploring further analysis. That further analysis, maybe if you can find some way that even that's not including the annual improvement, you are saying that possible, there is a possibility they can satisfy these two criteria. So, in a way, very difficult to understand why you suggested this kind of a further analysis on this topic, quite different from other assessment about other topics. Why?
Sue?
I think we should park the annual improvement. We've already voted on that and decided on the basis of annual improvement type criteria that we needed to make that clarification. I think we want to reopen that. But I thought that partly what you're getting at and sort of reading between the lines in paragraph 88 is, if I refer back to my comment earlier about being disciplined about things that we can actually do efficiently without disrupting things and getting caught up in months of deliberations, part of what you're assessing here is whether there's a way to address this that is an efficient and neat approach that doesn't cause problems and knock-on effects, right?
And the bigger problem includes...
So we think it's worth looking at, that's part of what you're considering.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, what I would say is that because of the importance of this issue, and we know it is important because of all the feedback, and because of the different ways that we could approach it, I think the staff think that it is worth bringing a paper, but we need to bring you a paper. We can't respond today to all the points you're making, because we are exploring ideas, but we need to set them out in front of you in an orderly and disciplined way. So what we've got in here is just something that's meant to indicate, yes, we've got some ideas that we'd like to explore with you, but we're not ready to explore them today.
Yeah, and to add to that, I think it's important to remember that the fact that we might have ideas, the fact we might want to explore them, and the fact that they might meet the criteria doesn't mean that we should. So the fact that we could doesn't mean that we should, and that's something we will also need to set out in a paper to evaluate. So it's not like we have a plan that's set out in stone that we're just going to unveil month by month. We are actively exploring some of these issues now.
Well, I must say I welcome the fact that you're going to explore, because if we came to the point of being able to make changes, this could be a good candidate in terms of increasing, in fact, consistency throughout the standard rather than diminishing it, in my view. Now, I mean, your analysis will tell us whether this can be done in a way that doesn't provide too much arbitrariness in implementation and also meets the criteria given the state we are in. Yes. So welcome your exploration.
All right.
Then topic number 8 is about the application of the risk mitigation exception, which is available for the biofuel contract. Do you have any comments?
No comments. No.
Then next topic is number 9, about the premium allocation approach and the treatment of premiums received.
No comments.
Okay, then topic 10 and 11 are both related to the business combinations, so I think that we can discuss them together.
Mary?
Might be a specific application of my request, my overall request for a bit more specificity, but I think it would be useful to remind, sorry, that's a word that's banned after this morning's discussion. I think it would be helpful to me to be reminded about an assessment of the usefulness, I have to use it, of the IFRS 3 information. You know, what
Because
we have to remember that there's a transaction that is being accounted for that presumably is a significant transaction to the entity, and what information about that transaction might be lost if some of the things we're being encouraged to consider were implemented. And it just doesn't seem to have picked up that side.
Yeah.
Again, not a criticism. I think you guys have done an amazing work when you didn't have, agreement on the criteria to think about how to do a first review. But this is just what would help me make decisions about meeting the criteria.
Okay, move on.
The next 3 topics are about reinsurance. So it's number 12, 13, and 14. They are slightly different technical aspect, but they are all in the context of reinsurance.
Doug?
Yeah, actually, this is really fundamental issues. And IFRS 17 doesn't cover the policyholder's accounting. Although the policyholder have a strong impact to the economics, but we are not trying to depict those economic differences. Having said that, if you are an insurer and you have a reinsurance contract, although reinsurance itself is the position of a policyholder, we try to do some accounting treatment. This is only because you have an underlying insurance. So in this sense, underlying insurance and reinsurance is a set of transactions. So we knew that. And if we could try to make a matching concept and the matching principle, that would be the idealistic situation. But it's not as easy as hedge accounting. So once we try to do that, it's very chaotic. So we decided not to do that. And then basically we are saying that reinsurance is a separate contract. So this has been done long time ago. And these issues were raised many times. But every time there was an issue raised, we reject it. We say it's a separate contract. So we now understand there is an issue, but still I think we should live with it. So that's what I think.
Well, on the first issue, on number 12, with the onerous contract being reinsured, I share your preliminary thoughts, and I welcome your preliminary thoughts. On the second issue, I was not able, in fact, and I don't know how you're going to expand this next time, but the question to me is whether reinsurance contracts, I was a bit, in fact, surprised with this issue of reinsurance related to insurance contract that were accounted for with the variable fee approach. Mm-hmm. I was not expecting that. So the question to me is whether reinsurance contracts exist, the cost of which to the insurer would have the reinsurer participate in the returns of the same pool of assets as the insurance contract. And I don't know that. I don't know whether these type of contracts exist or do not exist. But, you know, without having, if they exist, I would tend to think that the issue deserves consideration. If they don't exist, then probably not. But there is a big question to me. Do those contracts exist? And on the third one, so 14, I have the same comment as I had on the level of aggregation. Here, not a question of cost, but a question of relevance. And I think having a form of paper that is educational and that shows how the those requirements apply and why, we think that there is not an issue if that's the analysis we come to, it is a necessary step. In my view.
Mary?
Comments on issue 12 and 13. Let me do 13 first, because I think I might be coming at least one of Francoise's issues just from a different perspective. Because I am assuming, and I would like information about whether this assumption is correct or not, that if there is reinsurance for a contract that qualifies, where the underlying contract qualifies for variable fee approach, that the reinsurance is in respect of the insurance element of that and not the full participation in the increase or decrease in the pool of underlying assets. So some of that comes back to Francoise's request. If the reinsurance or the reinsurance contracts related to underlying variable fee contracts, if that reinsurance is largely just with respect to the insurance element, I think then it's a lot harder hurdle to explain what relevance the variable fee approach has, because the variable fee approach recognizes the integral nature of the investment aspect and the fact that the compensation is largely for investment management. And so I think understanding the nature of the reinsurance contracts and whether it's reinsuring the whole return or whether it's just the insurance aspect would be useful. And I'm going to chide Talk for his comment. There is no matching principle in the conceptual framework. There's a discussion of matching, but it's not a matching principle. and then back on issue 12, in your paragraph 120, I think it would be helpful to me in understanding your fuller explanation to look at whether or not there's a risk of losing information separately for the key aspects that I understand users are looking for. And what I mean by that is regarding onerous, grouping of onerous contracts, regarding, to me important, the separate existence of reinsurance. An insurer is not defeasing their insurance obligation by taking out reinsurance. And third is whether some of this information would be necessary anyway for reconciliation of the CSM, and changes in the CSM. Those are just things I think, rather than doing the analysis of is there loss of information at a high level, it might help in this case to do it at a bit more granular level, thinking about what we have heard are, key aspects of the model in this area.
Okay, then I can move to presentation. So this is topic 15 and 16, presentation in the balance sheet first, and then we can.
So I'm very cognizant of what the conceptual framework says here, and obviously that's consistent with what we say in IFRS 17. I think perhaps to take this forward, some very targeted user outreach may just be helpful here. Just to ask the users in terms of the utility, in terms of what's happening in terms of presentation.
So would be a help in that.
Francoise.
Well, my question was whether this issue had been raised while IFRS 17 was developed.
Was actually during the field testing in 2016, so was actually reported.
So by the end of the process, it was raised?
It was in the field test report.
Yes.
I've never heard of it.
All right.
Okay. Then item 17 is about the OCI option for the presentation. The issue was longly debated by the board. It's not new, I can guarantee that.
Just a brief comment. So this is something that we have heard consistently from our feedback with users, that they don't like this option. We do explain the risk full disclosure again. I'm not sure how costly it would be to actually come down to a single approach, but I appreciate it would be disruptive, if not costly.
Would be politically disruptive.
Indeed.
And I screwed up when we were talking about 15. The 15, I had a comment that I wanted to pass to the staff about your initial assessment, because one of the loss of information is comparability, both, you know, its consistency within the standard, but also with other IFRS standards. And on this one, I'm a bit surprised, given what have been long and difficult conversations that we've had in other areas of IFRS standards about offsetting and when offsetting is appropriate. Yeah. And to just look, the staff preliminary thought seems to it seems to be more open to offsetting than we have been in other areas. Now, if this is only in respect of a particular type of product or type of instrument that all of a sudden, you know, the cost-benefit balance is going here, and then suddenly for one thing, it's way different, then tell us about that, because this seems to be suggesting a much broader reconsideration of something that seems pretty fundamental and that we have examined twice, you know, more generally. And that seems to me to be a pretty significant potential inconsistency with other IFRS standards.
All right.
Okay. Then we have issue 18 about the definition of insurance contract with direct participation features. Figure out the scope of the variable fee approach compared to the general model. Nothing. Topic 19 is about interim financial statement treatment of accounting estimate. This was a challenge discussed at the COG meeting in September.
No comments. Nothing.
Then we have topic 20, 21, and 22 about the effective date.
Nope.
Okay. Whoa.
This one is where things to me get really complicated. So I'm surprised nobody had any comments.
I'm surprised that you thought the rest was easy.
No, I don't think the rest is easy. I actually really buy into what you said. Like, for me to show up and sort of re-deliberate everything, I'm totally on side. The place would totally collapse if we did that. This one's kind of a complex one in that, and it bothers me in the whole going forward in that we have some people out there who would really like us to get, in particular the users, this is a clear improvement. They'd like it tomorrow if they could have it, for the most part. And then we have apparently some preparers who are well along and don't really want it delayed. And then we have some preparers who argue that an effective and careful implementation requires more time than we've allowed. And then there are those who, mostly preparers again, but maybe some other groups, who want to see actual changes in the standard. That's at least
kind of four sets of stakeholders. And just on the effective date is if the ones in the third group who say, we're in favor of the standard, but we're going to be rushing it and you're going to impose a lot of costs, that's a different kind of set than the ones who've got a delay because they want one of those other 2019 items. And all I wanted to do was kind of comment that I think when we're going to think about this, that we keep in mind that we've got these different groups with different issues. It even went a little bit, I think, to what Gary said earlier, and probably not the same comment. He said some of those issues additional time might fix. So, you know, again, that's in the, you can reduce costs without changing the standard if that's the case. So that was my one comment on 20 is, I would like to keep track of the different reasons for the deferral a little bit. Second one on 21, some people, this is related to 20, some people have suggested that not doing comparative information would effectively buy a year. Mm-hmm. Others have said that this is really important to provide good information. Some preparers think it would be awful because they're very worried about how users will react. So again, that feeds into 20 in that we have a couple of groups with different views, that not providing the comparative would actually let you take, you know, some who want 2 years, some want 1 year and take away the comparatives. Those groups are very different. It's very different sets of information. So when we go through it, I'd like that laid out really clearly and if possible, some kind of a census on how many are in each group. And then I guess IFRS 9 probably has other complications, but I don't know what they are, so I'll be quiet.
Gary?
Yeah, the Tom sort of hit my point, but I think question 21 is really simply just asking for a year delay. I mean, it's really no different than 20, and honestly, I think there's going to be comparable periods sometime in the life of the standard, whether it's 2021 or delayed. Honestly, I would probably take 21 off the table. It's just an ask. It's just another way of articulating a delay for a year.
Sue?
One thing I would be interested in, if we could get it for the analysis on the comparative periods, is whether we can get any read from investors in terms of the experience of not having comparatives for 9 and 15. So I think that might be a relevant piece of information for us to be thinking about.
Ms. Raza.
Well, I'm reacting to issue 22, the default of IFRS 9. The way the preliminary sorts of stuff are written, basically you assess that the first criterion would not be met. So there would be a loss of information, and I think the motivations for the default, I mean, if IFRS 17 was delayed, would still be present. So I would want this to be carefully considered, so that we don't build up another controversy that cannot necessarily be easily, but can be avoided.
Zhang Wu.
Thank you. On topic 20, effective date, is it possible to have a kind of a two-tier model? Mm-hmm. You know, 2021 original effective date for the listed companies, but non-listed companies, you might be able to apply 2 years later, for example. No. Yes.
Nobody's doing it.
Sorry?
Is it still possible to early
decision.
Apply?
Domestic decision.
We would have, yeah, how
yeah,
do we
it's a regulated decision.
With this?
On Chung Wu's comments, just reacting to it, I think in the first instance it might not take much pressure out of the system, because I think we largely think of listed companies, you know, as the primary market for these standards, although we do have a couple of standard segments in earnings per share that only apply if you're a listed company. So there is some degree to which IFRS standards contemplate application by non-listed entities. That's the only thing. I just wanted to point out it's not a never been done before in that sense.
We do have a problem with subsidiaries and parents and other things, so I think it would be difficult for us to do this.
But in that case, that's the problem with the preparers. We don't have to worry about it because we are just having a kind of principle, like the.
But one of the things, and this is drawing on older experiences, one of the things we found out with IFRS 1 is that if you have different effective dates for parents and subsidiaries, that it creates quite substantial and ongoing transition result in the group's accounts and maybe doesn't deliver as much relief as it looks like it might at first glance. I think the IFRS 1 experience might be relevant there for parents that adopt before subs and subs that, you know.
I guess there's also a question about, you know, the usefulness of information and whether or not you think this information is useful for everyone to apply at the same time or not, because one of the big benefits is the comparability.
But generally, you know, the listed companies, non-listed companies, primary users are different.
Yeah.
So for the listed companies, you are providing all the same information at the same effective date, 2021. And non-listed companies...
It's not just the non-listed companies that are asking for a deferral of the date, it's also the listed companies. I'm not sure we would solve the problem that is set out here.
I'm not sure in the context of trying to do things efficiently that introducing something we've never done before is going to be ideal.
It's a much bigger deal.
Okay, Tom?
Just a small follow-up, though, on Cheng Wu thing is, in this case, in some jurisdictions, because you've got this mass of policyholders or something, there is a notion of public accountability, and they are a different set of users.
Yeah.
And notions of comparability are less critical. And so I'm inclined to agree with what Sue said, but I'm not clear that we shouldn't at least just stop and think about it for a second rather than rejecting it out of hand. But
okay, next slide.
The next group of topics is from 23 to 25 and is about transition.
Any comments? Okay, all problems solved. That's good.
I have enough feedback, I think.
Okay, that brings us to the end of, right? Yeah, yeah. Today. Yeah. Thank you. We gained 1 hour on for the implementation of IFRS 17.
Smaller the entity.